thank you very, very much to our sponsors this evening, who are Cetara. I can't believe, having spent a whole year looking forward to coming back to Ledbury, part one of the highlights of which, as well as the poetry, is the curry that I have every year at Cetara. I can't believe that I forgot to thank them for sponsoring this event. So, Cetara. I hope you'll forgive me and welcome me later in the week. And thanks, as always, to the Arts Council of England, who sponsor the whole festival. So, Luke Wright is just a fantastic performer. I'm so excited to be able to introduce him to you tonight. He's kind of doing a cut-down version of what is his ninth one-man show. He's got loads of books out, but only two of them are described as proper poetry collections, and they're both published by Penned in the Margins. And the first one, the reason I'm mentioning it is the first one, One Day, Oh Man. You know, people read you these fantastic blurbs and reviews. I'm going to quote the great Ian McMillan, who described One Day, Oh Man as an excellent book. If you know Ian McMillan, or even anybody from Yorkshire, you will know that is high praise indeed, and well deserved. Please welcome Luke Wright.
Oh, very exciting. Yeah, nice to be back in Ledbury. You seem like a long way away from me, but it's probably a safe distance. Right. I love Elvis. I always love watching Elvis do stuff. I do loads of gigs with him, and it's always an utter pleasure. But he made you laugh, but I'm afraid I'm going to talk about my feelings. Oh, England, heal my hackneyed heart. It's shot with guilt. And all those nights, I've shared it far too often, England. Bled it almost dry for eager eyes. Traded it for other hearts that turn to gristle in my grasp. Oh, nothing stirs this heart these days. The party tricks have left it sick. Oh, England, heal my hackneyed heart. Oh, England, heal my hackneyed heart. Show me clumps of pastel homes on hills. A couple holding hands in hail or chalkstone words of love in Dorset fields. Give me roads the motor clings to. Herons over tidal mud or skinny kids on wild swims. That constable bucolic thing. Oh, England, heal my hackneyed heart. Oh, England, heal my hackneyed heart. Wash it in the North Sea foam. Wrap it up in honey dawn. Make poultices from April dusk and chicken soup from sleepy days until it leaps and bangs its cage and till it thumps me with its thud and gives me all the grief it should. Oh, England, heal my hackneyed heart. I wrote that poem in Wales, actually. I must have been homesick. I was there for the Dylan Thomas centenary. A centenary that perhaps I should not have been invited to, seeing as that I knew nothing of the work of Dylan Thomas. I was self-conscious about this. So all weekend, I was effusive in my praise of Dylan Thomas. I really bigged him up like he was like my favourite poet. So much so that at the end of the weekend, I was invited on Radio 3 to talk about him. And they said, would I read one of his poems? I said, yeah, sure. Do you want me to do it in a Welsh accent, right? And they looked a little bit nervous. So I demonstrated my Welsh accent. They said, no, that's not really what they're after. Could I just do it in a normal voice? I heard it in response. It's a poem that I should have known, a poem that I know and love now, a poem called And Death Shall Have No Dominion. And I love the format of it, which is basically why I nicked it for that poem. I just took the verse structure of that, you know, the chorus line at the beginning and the end, and I nicked it. And I thought, to piss the Welsh off, I'm going to make it all about England, right, okay. Which immediately set me up for a problem, because I don't go around thinking about England all day, every day. I'm not Nigel Farage, right, whatever. And then I was thinking, what can I write this about? I would love to write a poem about, you know, I was inspired by, you know, how the Welsh embraced Dylan Thomas, and I kind of wanted to write about England in that way. You know, in a sort of non-racist way, can it be done? And I remember that a couple of weeks before I'd been in Frome in North Somerset. Do you guys know Frome? Yeah, see, well, it's where Jensen Button's from, you know, the Santander ambassador. I love his work. So I was really excited about going down there. So to discover this place, you know, where Jensen had developed his love of Spanish banks. And, I mean, I like all the Spanish banks, but Santander is the best, isn't it? So I was very excited. There was quite good spirits going down there. And on the way into Froome, I passed this massive hill, Clay Hill, Clay with an E, if you ever see, Clay Hill. Now, to you living out here, a hill, you know, whatever. But like, I'm from Essex. Like, hill's a fucking event for me. I was like, fuck me, a hill. And I had time. I was like, I'm going to climb the hill, right? So I pulled the car over and I climbed this hill. And I just had this vision of me getting to the top and throwing my arms open, like in the book Mole and the Baby Bird, right? And feeling a feeling, right? And I got to the top and I did that and I just felt nothing, right? Nothing. I just couldn't, you know, I couldn't raise my spirits, right? So that's what that poem's about, this moment. I couldn't have raised my spirits. And I sort of knew why this was. I think it's because there was a whole lot of difficult stuff in my life that I was refusing to think about, thinking that I was winning. It turns out I wasn't. So I've been trying to sprinkle my life with little moments of joy, right? That's my thing at the moment. So one of the things I've always loved doing when I was a kid, well, I used to love history. I loved history lessons, right? So I thought I'd get into history. But I don't know about you, because when I was at school, we only did two periods of history. I don't know about you, we did Tudors and Nazis. That's all we did. For 15 years, it was like Tudors in the autumn, Nazis in the spring. I do think Nazis in the spring is a great name for something, isn't it? Luke Wright's new collection, Nazis in the Spring. So as you know, there's nothing I couldn't tell you about Adolf Hitler and his six wives, right? I know the lot, okay? But I've decided to start filling in the gaps, right? Okay, and so my favourite period of history is the Georgian period of history, naturally, for a dandy like me. It's an amazing period of history from 14, something like that, right through to 1832. We had a run of Georges. George the First, George the Second, George the Third, George the Fourth, and it worked. It was like a fruit machine. It was like George, 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 ding, modern world. Everything we know, all the structures of our society were really kind of forged in this period. One of my favourite facts about this time is that we didn't have tabloid newspapers. Some people would argue that in itself is a good thing. But it's what replaced them, or you know, what was a precursor to the tabloids that I like. The broadside ballads. Do you know about these? These are basically poems, right? Printed on large sheets of paper, sold on street corners for a penny, concerning the gossipy, salacious news of the day. The sort of things that would get onto tabloids now, in Georgian, you know, like Frank Lampard's house being used for a dominatrix, that would be a classic broadside ballad material, right, okay? And these things were written very quickly and for money, not a lot of money, and they were mostly shit, right? And I love that. I think mainly because as a poet, I would be more relevant if we still had rhyming tabloids, right? I'd never be short of work. So I've been taking out these old Georgian ballads and trying to, like, rewrite them for the modern era. And thus far, I've done one. And I'm going to share you the sum total of my work tonight. This is about a bloke called Edward Dando, who was the apprentice to a hatter. And back then, if you were a gentleman, you could walk into any shop or restaurant, have what you liked, and say, put it on my tab, my good man, and then sweep out of there into a hansom cab, no wonder. And if you were the apprentice to a hatter, any kind of regular Joe, you couldn't do this, right? And Edward Dando was aware of this, thought this wasn't really very fair, didn't really have a way to fight it intelligently, so he just took matters into his own hands. I was about to say he was a Robin Hood type figure, but he just sort of stole from the lower middle classes and kept it. He was sort of halfway. He was a sort of half Robin Hood. But I find him kind of inspiring. So he's brought me some joy in what has otherwise been a difficult couple of years. Right, this is called The Ballad of Edward Dando, the Celebrated Gormandizer. Oh, and the opening line of the poem is, hurrah, it's me. And in case you're wondering, the me is me. That's how I just warm myself up the poem. Hurrah, it's me. Which I think is the best way of starting a poem. I think I'm going to start all of my poems like that from now on. I think Andrew Motion does that quite a lot as well. Hurrah, it's me. And then you just say whatever you're going to say. Hurrah, it's me. It's ballad time. Hang some fucking bunting. Now shut your eyes, sit back. We're off to 1820-something. The belching Georgian after party. An age of gout and laudanum where opulence and dropsy spread to all that could afford them. The spit roast swine, Germanic wines, Beau Brummel's ice cold quips, the clash of Nash's symmetry with George's wobbly bits. frayed pantaloons and riding crops and blue socks to the prigs. The Tories had the power, but it was all about the Whigs. And dandies dashed in hackney cabs from bar to drinking shop, a gin-soaked trail of tabs until their foppish waistcoats popped. And just as in our stage school age, the slack-jawed Chasnays dream of being auto-tuned and airbrushed into pop's harem, so young men walk the gaslit streets of London's rotten heart with grand ideas to take their lives and spin them into art. And so, our hero, Edward Dando, apprentice to a hatter. We don't know what his hats were like, but they, dear friends, don't matter. For days spent stitching hats for chaps sent Dando mad with boredom. A line of dandruff decades stretched out miserably before him. A member of that lunar race that history near forgot he might had he been born later, lined up with Marx's lot. But short on ideology or union or committee, Dando only had a hunch that life was sort of shitty. While some were blessed with tails and titles, others buffed their boots and pickled, stewed and boiled the scraps of labour's rotten fruits. Ah, who will pave my grave with jewels? Or who will sing of me? The hatters, blacksmiths, cooks and fools all piled up like scree. And that, thought Dando, shouldn't, couldn't be the way for him. So he resolved to live a life of shellfish, beer and vim. So off then to an oyster house, sawdust on the floor, a pile of shells around his boots, our hero orders more. Shuck, gulp, drop. Shuck, gulp, drop. And all washed down with porter. The swagger of a Don Juan with his mitts on someone's daughter, and when he'd swallowed 30 dozen. Dando belched and sighed, performed a dance of pocket pets. More rotten luck, he lied. I'm sorry, Mr. Oysterman. I'll have to see you clear another day. All right, old boy, next time I'm passing here. And had he been a gentleman, the trader would have bowed and sent him on his merry way, contented with this bow. But swagger isn't breeding. And no sooner out the door, this whistling cocksure hatter felt the rough arm of the law. They banished our voluptuary to Brixton for a month, where Dando's raging hunger gave the other lags the hump. They shackled him in solitary for stealing beef and bread, where there the old screws pummeled him and boxed his grisly head. But when his month of gruel was up, he just found the nearest stall, devoured 10 dozen oysters, and then coughed up bugger all. Alack, his choice of oyster man, this one built like a bull, left our hero in the gutter, sore but very full. So Dando spent his life like this, from oyster house to beating, from shellfish stall to court and jail, and all for sake of eating exactly what he wanted to, exactly what it when he wanted. For every bristling oyster man or judge that he affronted, he gained 100 new admirers. Dando strikes again. Could nothing sate his appetite for oysters, ale and bane? Till 1832 rolled around. The aged sailor king now on the throne. Austerity in place of George's bling, and Dando, like his royal exemplar, saw his fortunes fade. One August night, in Cold Bath Fields, on prisoner parade, our man collapsed with cholera. They carted him inside to a legend, a forgiving mistress. Claims before he died, they brought a dozen oysters to his licey prison bed. He rubbed his stomach down the lot, and then he fell back, dead. They buried him in Clerkenwell, beneath St. James's bells. The balladeers sung songs of him and paved his grave with shells. Thank you very much for sticking with that one. It's a very long poem about a man who once ate some seafood, so I appreciate your... I do like the historical fiction, though. I think I make that Ken Follett look like a right cunt. Now, Let's bring it up to date. And I think really on the same sort of topic, it was great to hear Elvis putting the boot into the powers that be, and quite rightly so. See, the difficulty is trying to write these political poems is you write them and then the world, you know, a week is a long time in politics, but it's almost no time at all in poetry. So that's why they're unnatural bedfellows. So for years, right, I wanted to write a poem about Ian Duncan Smith, right, okay? Exactly. Well, your response says it all. I mean, you know, what can I possibly have to add to the already enormous tome of Ian Duncan Smith's satire? Like, his lop's done him on national television. What can I? So I didn't, for years, I hesitated. All through that time when he was the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, I hesitated. I thought, what can I possibly add to it? I thought, well, and eventually I came to the conclusion, well, what if I sort of did something form-wise, right, okay? And that could be my take on it. So what if I wrote a poem about Ian Duncan Smith, but in that poem only used one type of vowel, right, in the whole poem? Okay, yeah, then maybe that, and I'd make a comment about the paucity he's inflicted on other people by simply deliberately inflicting that paucity of letter choice on myself, you know. Also, maybe even make a comment about the very impotent nature of satire itself. Sometimes you feel like you're operating with your hands tied behind your backs, and also just it would just be so difficult to do it. Everyone would be like, yeah, fair enough, let them do it, right? Now, the more literate amongst you, and I appreciate there will be one or two of you in here who are, will have noticed that I've got a problem writing a poem about Ian Duncan Smith that only uses one type of vowel. Is that you're there? Of course you are. Yeah, I'm not in Shrewsbury now. Like, I mean, look, there's more than one vowel in that name alone, isn't there? In fact, there's four vowels in his name. But thankfully, he's also frequently known by his initials, isn't he? IDS, right? Yeah, because it's shorter, isn't it? And because he reminds us of gastric complaints. So I immediately got around that problem. And I called this poem IDS. This poem's got no A's or E's or O's or... I'm sorry if I'm labouring this point, but thus far you look really unimpressed. Like, it's fucking hard writing a poem that's only got one vowel in it. You know? You try. You go home tonight, you'll be like, hello, fuck. Although fuck is fine. That's fine. IDS. This is. It's got to start somewhere. I couldn't just go Mississippi. It can't. I tried. It can't be done. This is IDS. This swinish thin grin, spilling, cringing scripts. Is IDS, this priggish birch whip, this piss dripping fright witch with whitish skin wig, this jiggling tit hitting skint Brits in mining districts, this grim Christ victimizing sick kids with dwindling tit bits, this is IDS mimicking kings, ripping ribs in glitz grills, licking his lips thinking this is bliss, piling it high, sipping his gin fizz whilst Brits flinch in wind chill, sticking pins in him, this is IDS inking his lists. Girls with six kids, inciting right-wing print kingpins, hissing pish, stirring fright, twisting victims till victims stink, till victims swim in ill will, till British dimwits drift right. This is IDS. I wish him midnight shifts. I wish him sinking ships. I wish him limp dicks. I wish him shit. Picnics in drizzling mist with ISIS. I wish him blind with hindsight. I wish him illicit kinship with pigs. And that goes for all of them. I don't really have a strong opinion on them either way. I mean... I could take or leave them, you know. But, you know, I just think, you know, life is... We make life hard enough for ourselves already without the government adding to it, you know. They should be there to help us, right? You know, I just... Because we do, and I make it hard for myself. I do. We all... Anyone who's ever tried to, like, do a thing or not do a thing and failed. That's all of us, right? Okay. Surely knows how difficult we make things for ourselves. Anyone's going, oh, I'd like to lose some weight. And then like 6 months later, they're like twice as fat as they were before. Those, you know, we know who we are, you know. Anyone's like, oh, I'm going to take up running, you know. Or anyone's just, you know, you know what I mean? Like anyone who's ever in bad situations that they could just get out of, but don't. We've all done that to ourselves. You know, the people who go back to, you know, people who go back to terrible relationships, they're treated bad. We do that, right? We set ourselves up in prisons of the mind, right? And this poem is about that. This is called The Minimum Security Prison of the Mind. And it's for all of us who are a bit shit at life. The food's so good, you think you're free. The screws call in, swap jokes, drink tea, and you know where they leave the key, yeah. You can walk out any time from the minimum security prison of the mind. Your inner eye roams rural streets. It falls on copses, fields of wheat. You douse your dreams in sweet deceits, yeah. You can walk out any time from the minimum security prison of the mind. Just one more fag, pill, burger, shot. Now smash the mirror, gild your lock, hand tinsel in your cell and cough fan. You can walk out any time from the minimum security prison of the mind. To be confined is much maligned. It's not as if the gov's unkind. Those bars are blinds, those bars are blinds. Those bare black bars are bijou blinds. And you can walk out any time from the minimum security prison of the mind and the sterile reek of piss and pine. You whistle while you stand in line. You love her, love them. This is fine. And you can walk out any time from the minimum security prison of the mind. Take back the years. This place is borrowed. Step away from torpid sorrow. I'm going now. I'll go tomorrow. Go tomorrow, oh, go tomorrow, oh, go tomorrow, and you can walk out any time from the minimum security prison of the mind. You can walk out any time. You can walk. You can walk. You can walk. So when I was a much younger man than I am now, and I can say that now, I'm 35 years old, okay? I feel that, don't, right, okay? That's the 35 fucking years I've put, that's a long time. I know, like, obviously some of you are older. It's the Ledbury Poetry Festival, naturally, of course you are. I know the demographic, right, okay? I'm just saying 35 years has got to count for something, right? It's got to count for something. And I do feel the need to say it sometimes, because I do still get ID'd. I got ID'd this weekend, right? I got ID'd, right? But the best one was I got ID'd in my own co-op, right? Okay. I don't own the co-op. I'm a member, so I guess I own a small part of it. Like maybe a parking bay. I don't know how it works, right? Okay. But it's a co-op, right? So I am technically their boss when I go in there. Okay. So I was in there at the time with my children. At the time, who were 2 and 5. And I was buying £60 worth of nappies and one bottle of wine just to numb the pain at the end of another day. And she goes, she scans the nappies. Yeah. She's like, have you got any ID? And I said, quite wittily, I thought, the fruit of my loins. Which, thank you, Ledbury, is a good line, isn't it? Nothing. Well, you could have borrowed those kids. Now, I'm no legal expert, but surely borrowing two children is a far graver offence than buying a bottle of wine underage. And even if I was 17 and I'd gone to the lengths of buying £60 worth of nappies and borrowing two children with my exact face, then quite frankly, that's an enterprising 17-year-old. Give them a fucking drink. I'm getting off the point. When I was a younger man than I am now, in my early 20s, I was in a poetry collective because I know how to have a good time. And in 2006, we were invited, as 4 of us, we were called Aisle 16, for reasons I'm not going to get into now. We were asked whether we'd come and play at John Betjeman's centenary event. Okay, I don't want to give the impression that I only do centenaries. I mean, I'll do any anniversary, I'll be there. If there are sandwiches and there's travel money, I'm there. I need someone. Anyway, so this is why I need you, Adrian, right? Okay, so... we went there, and keep in true to form, I didn't know much about John Betjeman at the time. I know a lot more now. And we went down there, and they said, would you do something special? So we thought, well, you know, we'll write something in honour of Betjeman. And we thought, well, what did Betjeman like? Betjeman loved ye olde England, the towny, villagey bits. We thought, fucking hell, he'd hate it now, wouldn't he, right? Okay, so we thought, what would he hate most about modern life? Let's see if we can write about that and see whether we can create that same quotidian splendour that Betjeman was so great at conjuring up. So we focused on motorway service stations. We thought he would hate those. They would be his modern bret noir. Do you know what I mean, right? So we went and lived in motorway service stations for a week. The idea was to live in there for a week. I think we did 4 days. This is right before I got married as well, right before my wedding. This is effectively my stag do, okay? So we did 4 days, and it was horrendous, and we hadn't gone into any towns for 4 days, just been living in motels and trying to write about Britain through the prism of service stations, and we thought, this is awful. This is our week off from work, right? So we realised that Betjeman was buried in a place called Trebetherick down in Cornwall. We thought, there's no service station down there. Let's make a pilgrimage to his grave. It'll make a nice, neat end to our show, and we'll just have to get out of this hell, right? And we can write about it. So we went down to where he's buried, and he's buried in St. Enedoc's Churchyard, which is in the middle of a golf course in Trebetherick in Cornwall. And we got there in a beautiful July day, sun-snog day, and we went and stood around this grave and tried to have some deep thoughts, things we, as 24-year-old men, we were incapable of doing. And then we went for a swim. And we did this show, and it was fine, right? And then like a month later, I got married, and I didn't really think much about it, and we moved on. 10 years later, last May, I found myself about 4 miles down the road from John Betjeman's grave at a wedding, and I'll be honest, right at the end of my own marriage, right? My own marriage was about to totally fall apart. And whenever that happens, you know, you always get invited to loads of weddings to be reminded. And so we did this, and the next morning I woke up very early with a bit of a hangover. I thought, I'm going to walk to this grave. And I was walking there, you know, thinking about my life, having some big thoughts, right? And then I walked through, I love the way the British countryside can prick your pomposity. I walked through a town called Pity Me. I love that. And I got to this graveside, and I wrote this poem. And I am fully aware that as a poet visiting the grave of another poet, I am on prime wank territory here, okay? So I thought I'd just go straight full on into it, and I've called this poem On Revisiting John Betjeman's Grave. 10 years ago, we slouched up here to you, a band of gobby boys against the world, a cobweb string of paying gigs to keep us from the dole. We walked up from the beach across the easy seventh hole, new beards and cocksure hair, and tried to forge ourselves a link, then fasten it to yours. The poem that I wrote claimed some success in this, but mostly it was mimicry. A ditty dashed like homework, then a rush down to the sea. Today I come at you from Pity Me, alone. Down salty Cornish lanes, their hedges heaving with the goods of May, until I reach the course and see the sunken church behind the green. Your grave is just the same. The stone looks fresh. Seems a decade has been kind to you. But what of me? For one, I know you so much better now. And back then, you were the bard of railways, of chintz and church and tea shop trysts and towns I'd never know. But now I see the terror, shame and sin, the longing for the lost. Your knife twist endings startle like a newborn's cry and heap their weight on me. And I wonder if you've ever been in this situation before. It's a Thursday night and you're sitting on the sofa, which is only half paid for, with your partner, and you, whatever you are watching's come to an end, like some gripping drama about some child murder or whatever we like to fill our time with. Your partner says, oh, I've got a really big day at work tomorrow. A lot of people are relying on me. I might go to bed. And you have no idea what that feels like. And so you say, you go up, I won't be long. I never said that before. You go up, I won't. That's a song of Britain, that. You go up, I won't be long. But of course, you're fucking ages, aren't you? Because you've got to watch Newsnight. Ugh. Then you've got to watch Question Time, which is like Newsnight, but with the public. No offence. And then you're like, ugh. You've got to watch Family Guy to bring yourself down, but someone's moved Family Guy from where it normally is. You come to bed about 6 in the morning. cry yourself to sleep for half an hour and then get up with the kids. You know, we've all been there, right? This is for you. It's called Lullaby. It's to keep you awake at night. In half-heeled homes and terraced streets, the suburbs sing their psalms. The charger buzz, the deadlock click, the far-off shrieking car alarm. I'm sorry, love, it's nothing much. Carbon protein fix. Remember how we used to eat before the kids knocked us for six, then here again. The half-bought couch, the supermarket wine, the drip-drip of our Netflix nights, the whittling of our brittle time. A soggy packed lunch Friday waits, so keep me from the sack. I can't admit that this is it, but she's got meetings back to back, and so to that familiar song, you go up. I won't be long. The sad refrain's a Big Ben's bong. Yeah, you go up. I won't be long. But now it's news night. Question time. I tell myself that things are fine as callow spads unreal like Sims or sing their grim familiar hymns. And this is what we'll leave our kids. The safety net in pieces. The walls well versed in double bar with telltale bloodstains down their fleeces. And what will I leave? Vented spleen. Four-lettered verbal litter, a spray of righteous leftist bile at people just like me on Twitter. Young and yet so weary, thumbs like scatterguns, another day of useless ire, exhausted, I ignored my sons. No, I've never cast a selfish vote, nor back to winner yet, but still I live in uplit comfort. Am I really that upset? I sing along to Britain's song, I pick my place among the throng, I say their words, so I belong. Yeah, you go up, I won't belong, but look around the towns and shires, all these gleaming steel glass spires and retail parks and malls so dear, and tell me who is thriving here. Apocalyptic Friday sales, 0-hour contract fails, offshore fixes, bedroom tax, while banks and business tip their hats to politicians flush with chips and healthcare firm directorships, the safe seats and consultancies that ring out our democracy, and couples like us, cleaved in two with no idea what we should do but proffer up this dour love to things that won't empower us, or knock back booze, or laugh it off, make strongholds under covers, or lose our reason now and then to scream at each other. I know it's awkward, that, isn't it, at the end, because you don't really want to clap at that, but it's fine, because poets are like fairies. If you don't clap, we die. Okay, so that's fine. And do you know what? Not long after writing that, I heard this brilliant story. I love this story. It sort of concerns John Betjeman. More accurately, it concerns his biographer, a man called Bevis Hillier. The name alone is worth noting. Bevis Hillier. And Bevis Hillier dedicated 25 years of his life to writing about the life of John Betjeman. And he produced three enormous volumes of biography. Now, when the second one of those came out, it was reviewed in the Sunday Times. This is about 2002. It was reviewed in the Sunday Times by A.N. Wilson. You know, literary big dog A.N. Wilson. You know, big, exciting moment, I should imagine, to be reviewed in the Times by A.N. Wilson. Right up until the moment that A.N. Wilson declares his utter fucking hatred for your book. And that's what he did. He wrote a really nasty poison pen review. Really, really snide, nasty. Very upsetting for Bevis Hillier, particularly when 3 years later, A.N. Wilson announces that he's writing his own little biography about John Betjeman, actually. And not only that, he's got a massive book deal, and it's coming out in Centenary Month, okay? He's, you know, really, Bevis Hillier thinks, right, fuck you. So, he fakes a letter, supposedly written by John Betjeman to a previously unknown about French lover. And he sprinkles this letter with just enough information to fool a Betjeman dilettante like A.N. Wilson. Like, one of the things he puts in there is he signs the letter off Tinkety Tonk, which is apparently is what some people believe Betjeman likes to sign letters off. He's not the only one. The Queen Mum used to sign off her letters, Tinkety Tonk, old fruit, and down with the Nazis, which I think is an excellent way of leaving a room. I think come in with, hurrah, it's me, and leave with, Tinkety Tonk, old fruit, and down with the Nazis. He then sends this letter to A.N. Wilson, posing as the French woman's daughter. Mr. Wilson, I was cleaning out the attic, and I found this letter. Perhaps you'd like it for your big, clever book. René. I should imagine. I've never met a French person. Ian Wilson falls for it, totally falls for it, puts the letter in there and thinks he's got this big scoop. Come publication day, you know, big fanfare, front cover of all the literary supplements, Bevis Hillier whispers in the ears of a few literary editors, you want to look at that letter? It looks a little bit fake to me. And he's found out, right? All the reviews are totally obsessed with the fact that Ian Wilson, the great Ian Wilson, has been duped. But not only that, the letter is an acrostic. The first letter of every sentence spells out, A.N. Wilson is a shit. And the T of shit is tinkety-tonk. I love that. I tell that to 16-year-olds. Say, do not stop being juvenile, okay? You can be a serious man of letters. Bevis Hillier is the man who coined the phrase Art Deco. Like, he's a serious guy. I fucking love that. And I thought, you know what? It's time to stop moping about breakup, right? Okay, and let's just play with words and see if we can work through it that way. So I thought, let's take all the vowels out again, right? And so we've only got you, okay? And let's see if I can write about breakup using only the vowel of you, okay? Can it be done? Exactly. Well, you know what's coming. Don't worry, I don't say the word cunt in this poem, okay? So I've spared your ears. This is about a bloke called Bert. And before you ask, it's Bert with a U, yeah. First draft had it Bert with an E. The whole thing didn't work. It fell apart. And it's called Bert Up Pub. Up Pub. Gruff bums guff. Gov. Pool suds, subs pump, dumb club drums, thump, 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 birds. Clue clucks, gut thug. Buzz cut nut. Skulks. Sups bud. Numbs grub. Thumbs sun. Slurs curds. Hucks lungs. Grunts burps. Grunts burps. Grunts burps. Grunts burps. Bzzz. Bzzz. Bert's fuck bud. Sues. Sues! Huh? 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 Sues dumps Bert. Sums up Bert's luck. Slut! Bert sulks. Bert hunts bunk ups. Ruth struts up. Yum, yum. Bert purrs. Sharp tubs. Yuck. Ruth's curt burst cuts Bert. None. Bert blurts hurt, but Ruth's mum turns up. Bert subs Ruth's mum's rum. Ruth's mum's flash. Ruth's mum's drunk. Ruth's mum's jugs jump. Drugs? Ruth's mum? Bert slurs. Ruth's mum rubs gums, gurns. Ruth's mum's numb up. Turd hut. Bert thumbs Ruth's mum's fur cup. Ruth's mum rubs Bert's plums. Ruth's mum sucks Bert's trunk, lustful slurps, mucus, lash, Bert clucks, Bert bums Ruth's mum's plump butt full thrust, cups Ruth's mum's sunburnt bust, ah, ah, oh, Bert spurts hummus up Ruth's mum's rump. Ruth's mum trumps. But Ruth's mum's fuck bud Kurt turns up. Gulp. Kurt buff. Kurt huffs. Kurt puffs. Kurt kung fu's. Kurt lugs Ruth's mum. Fans up. Bert hurls punch. But Kurt ducks. Kurt duffs. Bert up. Kurt runs. Bert slumps. Bert's skull burns. Bert's gut hurts. Bert hurls chunks. Fuzz turn up drunk. Bert thumps fuzz. Dumb stunt fuzz. Cuff Bert. Run Bert up fuzz. Church. Gov shuts up pub. Suburb lulls. Dusk. Hush. Dust. I sent that one to Nationwide. Nothing. I tell you what, if that doesn't make you want to settle down and get a mortgage, I don't know what will. They're blinkered, that company. Blinkered. Oh, well. And I'm sorry for doing that to hummus in a place like this. Quaint market town starves after poetry gig. Look, it's really late. I'm going to just do one more and then I'm going to fuck off and leave you alone and we can just pretend this never happened. Thank you very much for coming out tonight. I really, really appreciate it. For me, it's utter joy to come to this beautiful town and to see my colleagues and to work with, I think, arguably the nicest man, definitely in poetry, possibly in the whole of the UK, Elvis McGonagall, my good friend Richard Smith. Can we hear it for him one more time? He's... See that guy? I love that guy. I've had to sort of truncate the show kind of massively, so there's other arcs and what they call beats in theatre, but hopefully you got some of it. All the work's come from my collection of Toll, which I don't have to flog to after the show. I'm often flogging books, but I've run out. But I believe they sell them in all good bookshops. And even in the one here in Ledbury, they sell them here. They've got them here. I don't know. I've never been in the... I'm sure it's an excellent bookshop, but okay. I think they've got them here. They're £10 each, but if you get two, it's 20 quid. So it's worth... get one for a friend. And I'm going to just leave you on a poem that's not in that book. It's from my last book, but it seems like an appropriate end. I live in a little town called Bungay now, which is in North Suffolk, and I'm very happy there. And Bungay is very much a wet town, right? At one point, before the First World War, we had 40 pubs, right, in a town of about 2,000 people. Yes, I know, right? Now, as a town of about 5,000 people, we have 4 pubs, and they're closing down at an alarming rate, and it's because, you know, Sky... supermarkets, all those sort of things. And what happens is nothing for them to become the pubs when they close down. There's no business big enough to go into them, so they become houses, right? And people tend to move up from London, and they paint everything white. And then, I don't know if you've seen this, don't they do it around here? They do it around my way. They leave the sign, right? Because it's like it's really authentic, yeah? And yet, if you barge in there and demand refreshment, they get really shirty with you. There's one of these on my road, it's called The Ship. And if you look through the window of The Ship now, it's just a darkened room with a fat man watching Sky Sports. I mean, The Ship is still a pub, but, you know. Thank you. I sometimes that doesn't fly, but I like that joke, right? So anyway, this is to anyone who's ever liked a drink, anyone who's ever liked to sit in a pub, this is for the lament for the lost boozers of Blighty. And it's called Houses That Used to Be Boozers. This town has a stark share of repossessed dark lairs of houses that used to be boozers. Where once we were drinking, we're now slowly sinking in sofas the colour of bruises. Hex sawdust saloons and our minimalist rooms where every night somebody chooses to rest their behind and half silence their mind in a slow death of sweaty neck snoozers in a tap drip of box sets and docks. But these houses, they used to be buzzing, they used to be busting and splitting and spitting and ripe. These places, they used to be toastless, they used to be graceless and legless and feckless each night. Down lopsided streets, factory workers would meet in these houses that used to be boozers and wash the week's slog and the honeydew grog of their bawdy and dubious ruses. Now, ladies for his hair in the glade plug and air of these houses that used to be boozers. So far from the funk of the blood, sweat and spunk when these houses were floozy-filled boozers, when these houses were ringing with song. And I long for the throng of the song we thrive in these dives of their ligging and frigging and dirt, these hell holes are black-hearted arseholes and poor souls and sing and kick heads in till everything hurts. Farewell, Rose and Crown, for the ship has gone down. She's no more for rum-infused cruises. The mad horse and dray is not bucking today. No, he's muzzled as McIntyre muses and clatters of pewter are taps on computer in houses that used to be boozers. Humdrum sobriety, there's no society. Houses that used to be boozers. In cordoned off hush, we are turning to mush. in these houses that used to be boozers. We're fingering phones and we're drinking alone. In these houses that used to be, houses that used to be, houses that used to be boozers. Thank you very much, Debrie. Thank you.